Good morning. We're delighted to welcome you all to our last scheduled oral argument for the month of October. We have with us special guests, Wisconsin Lutheran High School students. Would they please stand? Thank you for coming. You may be seated. And we have Mineral Point High School students. Would they please stand? And thank you all for coming, and you may be seated. The students are here with a program that is sponsored by the State Bar of Wisconsin and the Wisconsin Supreme Court. This program is cleverly entitled A Court with Class. It's a national award-winning program that brings students to the courtroom. We invite students from around the state to come and join us for an oral argument. If the invitation is accepted, the students are sent materials about the case. They may engage in special activities relating to the case. They come and listen to an oral argument and then speak with a justice assigned for that day to talk with the students and anyone else who is interested. And we discuss the procedures of the court in deciding which cases to take, hearing the case, and writing the opinion on the case. The discussion is on procedure, not the substantive issues of the case that the students hear. Before I introduce the court, does anyone in the audience wish a summary of the case we are about to hear? If so, would you raise your right hand or left hand, as you wish?
Or both.
All right, hearing none, or both hands, I'm told. let me introduce the court to you all. On my far right is Justice Annette Ziegler. Seated next to her is Justice David Prosser. To my immediate right is Justice Anne Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice, and I will meet with the group immediately after this hearing is concluded. And then after the hearing is concluded and after my brief discussion with the group, the court will meet in closed conference to decide this case, at least tentatively. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks, and to his left, Justice Patience Rogensack, and on the far left, Justice Michael Gableman. With those introductions made, I will call our first case, which is 09AP2907CR, State v. Joseph J. Spaeth. Arguing for the state is arguing on behalf of the defendant is Assistant State Public Defender Shelley Feit. Arguing on behalf of the state will be Assistant Attorney General Sally Wellman. Ms. Feit.
May it please the court, my name is Shelley Feit, and I represent
Joseph. Ms. Feit, I think if you raise the podium and get the microphone closer to you, this is a high-tech podium.
That's fine. Thank you, I appreciate that. As I said, my name is Shelley Feit, and I represent Joseph Spaeth. In 2006, in response to questioning, Mr. Spaeth told his parole agent that he'd tickled his nieces, and in doing so, had brushed against their private areas. The agent immediately gave this information to police, who picked Mr. Spaeth up, asked him about the subject of his statement, and got a new, very similar statement. The police statement has always been the state's only evidence that a crime may have been committed here, especially given that the parents of the nieces were present for the tickling and it didn't cause them concern.
Counsel, I want to focus on the facts. Is it just this I don't mean just, but is it this one incident or were there other incidents involved?
I believe it was a family gathering, and it was either one or two incidents, but in very close time in family gatherings.
Would those one and two incidents be within the 30-second time period that had been alluded to in the facts?
Correct. Correct. Mr. Spaeth's first statement to his agent was given under a grant of use and derivative use immunity, a longstanding rule set by State versus Evans.
Counsel, you're not saying, are you? I want to make sure I understand the parameters of your argument as applied to this case and future cases. The statements that he made can be used against him for purposes of revocation of parole, revocation of probation, in the instant case that he was convicted on, right?
You mean that he was convicted on that he was on parole for?
Right.
Yes.
Yeah. But you're just saying you can't use that compelled testimony, if you will, as a basis for a wholly new independent charge.
That is correct.
And there are occasions when that can happen, but those occasions aren't present here, like perjury, for example, or...
That's right. And, you know, in addition to revocation of probation or parole, there's a number of things that the state can do with evidence that is immunized or that's derived from immunized testimony. Essentially, the only thing they can't do is use it in a criminal proceeding against the defendant. So in addition to revocation, 980, TPR, other sorts of things like that.
So, could I ask, I really need some clarification here. This gentleman was on parole. Did he had periodic visits with his parole officer?
Yes.
When he visited his parole officer, were all of those was there immunity granted for his statements in all of those visits?
Well, in State versus Evans, what this court did was say that in Wisconsin, probationers and parolees had to answer the questions of their agents truthfully, and that that would include questions that would require potentially incriminating responses. Because this court made that decision, it constitutionally had to make the second decision that it made under both Castigar and under Minnesota versus Murphy, and that is that the answers to those questions would come with a grant of use and derivative use immunity. So it's about the questioning between the agent and the probationer and parolee.
So it really doesn't involve a polygraph exam alone. It's a regular basis in your it's a regular interview and with immunity following from that. Is that correct?
That is correct. I guess I just wanted to clarify that. Let's say a probationer or a parolee were to volunteer information to their agent, or their agent were to ask a question that didn't require a potentially incriminating response. That wouldn't come with a grant of use and derivative use immunity. But at any time that the probation agent or parole agent or their staff, I suppose, like a polygraph examiner, is asking a question that requires a potentially incriminating response, that comes with a grant of use and derivative use immunity. And that is a constitutional requirement that this court recognized in State versus Evans.
I understand.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Jessica.
Did I understand you to say that if the parolee volunteers a statement, that is not covered?
What I'm saying is if he goes to see his agent, and the agent says, "How are you doing?" And the parolee at that point says, "Well, I killed my wife yesterday," that's a different situation because it's not in response to questioning by the agent. Under Evans, any questioning that a parolee or a probationer has to answer honestly any question put to him by his agent, and then the extra step that's so important in Evans is that it said, even if your answer is potentially incriminating.
Well, what was the question that was asked to Mr. Spaeth parole agent that led to the incriminating statements?
Well, it's not clear. There's not a transcript of the exact questions, but what the probation or what the polygraph examiner and then the probation agent were asking Mr. Spaeth was about contact he had with children, because it was part of his parole rules not to have contact with children. And then further, we're asking him questions to see whether that contact with children involved criminal behavior, if there was any touching of private areas.
Is it your view, then, that there is no way to evaluate the initial interview circumstances, splitting polygraph questions from anything that followed right in that initial interview? Is that your position?
Well, the polygraph questioning was all part of, I mean, it was all part of the questioning by his parole agent. The polygraph examiner was interviewing Mr. Spaeth as directed by the agent. And so really, that's all part of the same thing. This case is not about polygraph evidence per se, or the case law involving polygraph evidence. It's really about the use and derivative use immunity that's granted to probationers as a result of the rule that they tell their that they respond to their agent's questioning in a truthful manner, even if the answer is potentially incriminating.
He was required to take the polygraph, wasn't he?
Yes, as a condition of parole.
Condition of parole, so you must take the polygraph. So when a question was asked under the polygraph, there's a compelled response. Isn't that your position?
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor.
Justice Crooks.
Now, Ms. Fine, I just wanted to clarify. It's my understanding that the state did not use and is not trying to use the statements made to the probation agent. Rather, the focus here, as I understand it, is on the statements made to the police later. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And it's further my understanding that you take the position that those statements made to the police later were still compelled because of what had occurred earlier. Is that right?
That's sort of right, Your Honor, but I do want to be clear here that there are two issues in this case.
Oh, I understand that.
And I think it's always been a little confusing that Mr. Spaeth argues that his statement is inadmissible under both the Castigar standard and the Bayer standard.
Under the what standard?
I'm sorry, I'll call it the Bayer standard. It comes out of the line of cases beginning with U.S. v. Bayer. The Castigar standard is not so much about the compulsion related to the second statement. Bayer is really about whether the initial compulsion carries over. Essentially, the second statement is considered compelled, even if there's no independent cause for it to be compelled. The Castigar standard Castigar set out a system for requiring a person to make an incriminating statement in a constitutional and a judicially enforceable way. It's a different standard. The government can formally compel an incriminating statement, but then it has to treat the person as if they never made the statement for criminal purposes. So
Castigar involved, if I understand it correctly, a federal immunity statute. Is that correct?
That's correct.
We're not dealing with that here. We're dealing here with what our court did in Evans. Is that right?
Right. In Evans, like I said, the court decided that they had to answer those questions even if they're incriminating. And therefore, it's really Minnesota versus Murphy that's the more specific United States Supreme Court case that comes out of Castigar. Castigar was about a grand jury, sort of a traditional immunity situation. Then later you have the U.S. Supreme Court case Lefkowitz, where they say the Castigar rule also applies to informal situations. And then you get Minnesota versus Murphy, where they say it also applies to probationers and parolees if a state makes this one last step. It's one thing to say that probationers and parolees must be truthful to their agents. However, if they take the extra step of saying that that's true even if the answers are potentially incriminating, then it does come with a grant of use and derivative use immunity. And in this case, like you said, it's not so much the initial immunized statement, but it's the derivative use of that statement in getting the second statement to police.
Well, the state here takes the position, as I understand it, that there is attenuation. In other words, that you've got different interrogators, you've got a different location, you've got Miranda warnings given, you've got a number of other significant things that occur between what's told to the agent and what's told to the police. How do you handle that argument?
Well, that argument is relevant under the second issue, under the Bayer standard. But the Castigar...
Just for clarification, when you're talking about that, you're talking about voluntariness?
Yes.
Okay.
That's correct. So we're talking about voluntariness versus derivative use of an immunized statement. The derivative use standard focuses more on what the government is using, because the government has been able to formally compel a statement. They have the power of the judiciary there to enforce that right to compel a statement. But in return, they can't then use that statement in their investigation. And so it's not focused so much on the defendant and whether the compulsion, the initial compulsion has dissipated to some extent or is attenuated to some extent. And also it's not focused on deterrence, which is an issue in the Bayer standard. Instead, it's simply focused on, did the government formally compel the statement, then turn around and use the statement to find some other usable evidence? Because if the government does that, then it's not putting the person in the position that he would be in if he hadn't made the statement. He's in a much worse position.
One of the interesting arguments I found made by the state was what I would call a policy argument. It's an argument that, look, probation and parole agents have to report to law enforcement when they're told about abuse, when they're told about a violation of the law, and that if we were to accept your argument, that would effectively eliminate cooperation between the probation and parole agents on one side and law enforcement on the other. How do you answer that? That seems to be a pretty powerful policy argument.
Well, there's actually several answers to that. The first one that I'm not sure that I was clear on this in my reply brief, but parole agents are not mandatory reporters under the mandatory reporting statute. There is a DOC administrative code provision.
Yeah, and that's what I'm referring to.
But it tells them to either tell about the criminal behavior to their supervisor or to the authorities. That's a pretty big way out, if that's something that parole agents are concerned about, is that they can report it to their supervisor. It's a little more specific with child abuse and that they have to report it to authorities, and then there's a citation to Chapter 48. So it seems like it probably means the county department. So there is some requirement there, but it is not that they go directly to police. But then, you know, there's a couple of other responses to that question. The first one is, we're looking at a constitutional rule. State versus Evans held as it did because it was required under the Constitution, and particularly if you look at Minnesota versus Murphy, that's pretty clear, that if they take that extra step of requiring them to answer incriminating statements, it has to come with a grant of use and derivative use immunity. But then the second answer to that is really, if this court is concerned about the policy, this court can overrule Evans in its entirety. You can say, from now on, probationers and parolees in Wisconsin can plead the Fifth if a question of their agent requires a potentially incriminating response, and not face revocation for that. And that's what many, many other states do as their rule because of the Minnesota versus Murphy rule. And if it does that, then the court can also eliminate the grant of immunity discussed in Evans. And if prosecutors want to grant immunity on a case-by-case basis, they could do that. But that's not going to affect this case, because Mr. Spaeth was granted the use and derivative use immunity under the Evans scheme.
Counsel, one of the... Justice Crooks, are you finished?
Yes, I am. Thank you.
One of the issues that causes me to pause is the relationship between voluntariness and the test for voluntariness and the Castigar test. Now, both of those are at play. And my question to you is this. Even if the statement to the officer is considered voluntary because of attenuation, essentially, going through a voluntariness test, attenuation from that which was given to the probation officer. Even if it's voluntary because of attenuation, how does that fit into the next test, the Castigar test? I think it's easy to conflate the voluntariness test with the Castigar test. So explain to me, once it's, you say, okay, it is voluntary, you know, there's a different location, different interrogators, go through the factors, and you come out and say it's voluntary to the law enforcement. You next go to the Castigar. Explain to me so that's not conflated, how it's an independent test.
Well, first of all, Your Honor, I would disagree that it's voluntary, which is, of course, again, the second issue in this case. But in response to your question, these are two different lines of cases. They come out of separate United States Supreme Court cases with very different histories. And Castigar, because, again, it's not exactly an agreement, so I don't want to say it's a bargain per se, but essentially the government gets something it otherwise has no power to do, and that is to legally, constitutionally get someone to make an incriminating statement. Whereas the buyer standard, again, it's really about keeping government agents from illegally compelling statements. That's the cases it comes out of. So the Castigar standard is focused on what the government is doing with the information. It's not just focused on is the defendant, the compulsion that made him make the first statement, did that have some, was it still involved when he made a second statement? It's really about, did the government use that information? And if you look at, you know, a lot of the federal cases, that includes things like if in questioning a witness, the government gets their questions from reading immunized statement, then that's not admissible under Castigar because the government is using something they're not allowed to use under the rule. So it's really two different focuses in these standards.
Ergo, derivative use immunity, that label, it's derived from an immune statement. But what is the test, or what's the analytical framework, then, that is to be applied in a Castigar analysis?
The Castigar analysis is, there's a lot of language in these cases. It's very strong. It has to be wholly independent. There must be an independent source of information that led to the evidence. The immunized statement can't be used to search out testimony against the speaker of the immunized statement. The state in its response brief talked about this kind of super strict, this tough test. Well, yeah, it is a very tough test. And it's a tough test because it's allowing the government to do something that is otherwise completely impossible for the government. And really, it's often a pretty good deal for the government because, like I said, they can use it for revocation, for 980. They can protect victims. They can get a no-contact order. They can do just about anything except use it against the speaker in a criminal proceeding.
How do you distinguish this case from Minnesota v. Murphy? In that case, they held that his statements to the parole or probation officer could be used against him.
I'm sorry, could you repeat that last part?
They could, in Minnesota v. Murphy, the majority of the court held that the statements that the defendant made to the agent could be used against him. How do you distinguish this case from Minnesota v. Murphy?
In that case, the court noted that the Minnesota Supreme Court had never said that in Minnesota, probationers and parolees would have to answer their agents' questions truthfully, even if the answers were incriminating. So they said that they would assume that under state law, that in response to a question that would require a potentially incriminating answer, that probationers and parolees could plead the Fifth. So they talked about this extra impermissible step. I can get an exact citation for you, but in Wisconsin, Evans did exactly that. It took the extra step. It said that you have to answer questions even if the answers are potentially.
Now, is that in the general rules for probation and parole, or did the agent here say that to Mr. Spaeth?
It is in the general rules of probation and parole, and I believe as part of the general rules, the agents tell each of their clients that at the beginning of the relationship. It's not clear whether she told him that in this instance, although, again, the testimony is just not entirely clear on that.
Mm-hmm. Because in Minnesota v. Murphy, Murphy was not expressly informed during the crucial meeting with his probation officer that an assertion of the privilege would result in the imposition of a penalty.
Right.
And that's after a discussion of generally the Minnesota rule that not necessarily would you have a penalty.
That's correct. And that's when I was speaking about what this court could do in the future with Evans, it would essentially be how the Supreme Court interpreted the Minnesota rule, which is you still have to answer your agent's questions honestly, but when you get to the step of asking an incriminating question, then you can plead the Fifth. And Evans was just crystal clear that in Wisconsin, as a state rule here, you have to answer even those questions or face revocation.
I understand the state's position, and we'll ask the state. They are asking that the attenuation rule be applied here. And the attenuation rule, as I understand, is not only voluntariness, but any time there would be a suppression of particular evidence. The question is the evidence that's used is somehow attenuated from the suppressed evidence. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
Well, what's the matter with using that? If we don't use the attenuation rule, and this is back to, I think, the question that Justice Crooks asked, if we don't use that, what we have is a situation is somebody is on probation and parole. One of the conditions of parole is that you not only follow all the conditions, don't drink, don't use substances, illegal substances, come home at night at 8 o'clock, and don't commit any crimes, right?
Yes.
So you go to your probation officer, and what you can do is you can commit a whole series of crimes in the last week, 2 weeks, whenever you haven't seen the probation officer, and then you say to the officer said, you have an interesting time this week. You a good fellow, and or even says, have you adhered to all the terms and conditions, right? And he says, no, I haven't. I did the following things. I held up a bank, you know, I committed rape, etc. And under your rule, he becomes immune from all this crime. All he has to do is fess up, and then he can go to prison for 2 years because he's violated his probation. That doesn't seem like the right kind of thing, that he can immunize or protect or somehow make confidential all these confessions and stop the police, in effect, from ever finding out because they don't have any independent evidence. They don't even know the bank's been robbed yet.
Well, first of all, Your Honor, it's not clear that the questions that you're talking about are really questions that would require a potentially incriminating response.
Okay, you make up the question. You make up the question and I'll incriminate myself. I don't intend to avoid that. I being the probationer.
Okay, so the question would be, have you assaulted any children?
Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
Well, there's a couple of things. Again, this court is welcome to revisit Evans. But also, that's...
Do you want us to revisit Evans?
I really take no position on whether you revisit Evans because under the current law, Mr. Spaeth's statement to police was inadmissible. And so all I'm saying is that if this court is concerned about these policy concerns, that's something that it could do going forward. And so really, Mr. Spaeth, it doesn't matter for his case whether you make that choice. But in addition, Well, there's a couple things. First of all, this case is pretty unusual. In a typical, you know, probation, parolee situation, you have someone who commits a crime, the police find out, they inform the agent starts questioning the person about it. There's an investigation already going. Generally, agents aren't just sort of firing off questions about criminal behavior. But I think if you look at the possibility under the current scheme for somebody to try to game the system, which is essentially what you're talking about, it's certainly, there's no suggestion in this case that that's what Mr. Spaeth was doing. But you have to look at the other side of the state's ability to game the system under their system, which, again, I don't think that what they're asking for is constitutionally permissible. But if you could put someone on probation and then ask them anything you want, and then you wouldn't be able to use those answers, but you could just tell the police and have them investigate it. What would keep the state from putting a suspect in a serious crime on probation for a fairly minor crime, and then asking all sorts of questions about their criminal behavior, revoking them if they think that they're dishonest or they're not answering? But then if they do answer honestly, with, you know, the belief and the understanding that they've been granted a use and derivative use immunity, then the police get that information. They simply go investigate the crime. They search out evidence maybe the person is told about. I mean, there's a possibility for the state to behave inappropriately under what would essentially be a simple use immunity scheme, which, again, is simply unconstitutional. I mean, that's been true since Councilman V. Hitchcock, that you must have at least use and derivative use immunity. For a while, there was a question whether it was transactional or whether it was use and derivative use, and it was Castigar that clarified that.
Thank you, Counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
May it please the Court, Assistant Attorney General Sally Wellman representing the state, which is the plaintiff respondent in this case. It's our position that the Fifth Amendment of the Federal Constitution and Article 1, Section 8 of the state Constitution do not bar admissibility of parolee space statement that he made to the police after his parole agent told him he didn't have to talk to the police, he could have a lawyer, he wasn't compelled to tell them anything, and after the police separately, when they got him to the police station, gave him his full Miranda rights, and he knowingly, voluntarily, and intelligently waived those and chose to make a statement.
Ms. Wellman?
Yes.
You're not using the statements he made against his own interest in to the parole or probation officer?
Absolutely not.
Absolutely not. So that's covered by Castigar.
It's covered by Evans and Minnesota versus Murphy, yes.
Who aren't they based on Castigar?
They cite to Castigar, yes.
Okay. So what you do is you're having something totally separate.
Right. Even though the police would not have been interviewing him but for the fact that he had first told his agent of conduct that may constitute a crime, and she reported that to the authorities, both as a mandatory reporter of possible child sexual assault, and because she believed that the probation and parole rules require her to. And they certainly can be, their own rules can be read to require her to.
How would you have us define derivative use? What's derivative and what isn't?
I'm searching in my mind to think whether any of the case law specifically defines it, and I don't know that it does.
Why is this independent and not derivative? Law enforcement wouldn't have been interviewing him about this if they weren't told by the agent, hey, he just told me this. And I can't use it against him for subsequent criminal proceedings, and you can't use what he said to me in subsequent criminal proceedings, but I'm just telling you, wink, wink, nod, nod, he admitted to this activity. And then law enforcement takes that information and starts interviewing him. How is that not derivative? I just need to know how we make this clear as to what is and is not derivative from what the probation agent learned during the course of a legitimate and appropriate probationary or parole or extended supervision interview.
It certainly is derivative in that sense of the word that it would not have happened but for the agent first talking to him and then telling the police, because the police didn't have any idea that a crime had occurred. What our position is that notwithstanding that, it's constitutional, because we go back and we look at the first principle, which is what is it that the Fifth Amendment requires. And Castigar says that the Fifth Amendment allows compelled testimony if it's then you're given protection that protects you from the very dangers that the Fifth Amendment protects you from, which is self-incrimination. And the way that they said it was permissible in that case, because it's what the statute already provided that they were looking at, was use and derivative, very broad derivative use immunity. What we're saying is that's all well and good, and that's all well and good to some extent in the probation area, but it doesn't answer the question we have here, because the question we have here was not presented there, which is there another equally constitutional way to protect him from the dangers of self-incrimination that could come from derivative evidence? And the answer is yes, and it's doing what we did here, which is you give him his self-amendment rights back again in this new arena. The police tell him, and his agent told him, you don't have to talk to us. It's your choice. And giving him that choice is the greater protection, really, than the Castigar.
As then law enforcement properly Mirandizes the person and it's voluntary under Edwards, it then is fair game.
Yes,
derivative use immunity really means derivative is okay so long as law enforcement gives you Miranda warnings.
What we're saying is derivative protects you if that's all that's going on. But if we protect you a different and, I believe, better way on the front end, by giving you your Miranda rights and giving you the choice as to whether we can even get that derivative evidence. We can't even get the statement if you don't waive your Miranda rights. In Castigar, the witness is, one reason the Castigar is so broad, I think, is that the witness is relegated, their only protection comes in at the back end. They give their testimony at the grand jury or trial under a grant of use and derivative use immunity. Then they sit back. They have no control, no knowledge, no way of knowing what the government does with the contents of that statement. Then if the government files new charges against that witness, then the government has to show that they got that from a wholly independent source. Here we're putting all of the benefit to the defendant on the front end and saying, Mr. Parolee, you get to decide whether we get a second statement or not, because you have the right not to talk to us. I don't see how that offends the Fifth Amendment. It's more protection than he would have to have. Now, Castigar doesn't say you can do it, but that's because it simply didn't address that question.
Here's what Castigar says. Make sure I'm reading from the right opinion. There's several. We are clearly of opinion that no statute which leaves the party or witness subject to prosecution after he answers the criminating question put to him can have the effect of supplanting the privilege conferred by the Constitution of the United States. The immunity statute under consideration does not supply a complete protection from all perils against which the constitutional prohibition was designed and is not a full substitute for that prohibition. So this is a constitutional case that says, what does the Constitution require when you're under compelled questioning?
Right.
And it says, then, in view of the constitutional provision, a statutory enactment, which would mean any government action, to be valid, must afford absolute immunity against future prosecution for the offense to which the question relates. I'm reading from, this would be 92 Supreme Court 1660 or 406 U.S. 450, 451. I don't see how you can get around that language. I know that the brief talks about that Castigar is a statutory interpretation, deals with the statute, but it really says the statute's invalid because the Constitution requires, as I read this, Constitution requires that, I hope I'm not reading from the dissent, but the Constitution requires that. And I don't know that that would make any difference. So that's why I have a hard time getting around that. By you're now saying, and that was Justice Powell's opinion for the court, you're now saying, oh, we're giving him better protection because we're Mirandizing him twice, in effect. We're telling him he doesn't have to talk. But that's not what Castigar seems to interpret the Fifth Amendment to be.
Well, what Castigar interpreted was the statute before it, which gave the suspect use in derivative immunity. It simply didn't have occasion to say, what if, instead of doing that, we went back to the witness each time and said, look, you talked about Joe and you did this crime together. We want to go talk to Joe and see what he says you did. You can prevent us because you don't have to let us do it. Would that be okay? I mean, in a sense, that's sort of what we're doing here. We're saying, we would like to get a statement from you that we could use in court, but you can prevent us, and it's your choice. Counsel. And Castigar doesn't prohibit that because it simply doesn't address it. I agree. Absent any of that happened here, then you may be in a Castigar situation. But Castigar doesn't prohibit this, nor does Evans, because they weren't faced with whether would this also be constitutional.
Counsel, the Castigar court, besides the wholly independent language, has another test, and it puts an additional burden, as I read it, on the state when the state is dealing with immunity or derivative use immunity. And it says...
What page you went?
457.
All right.
And it's referring to the Murphy Court also. But it says that the government now is an additional burden to put the defendant in, quote, substantially the same position as if he had claimed his privilege in the absence of a state grant of immunity. If that's the test, how can you say that Mirandizing takes care of any problem? Because if it is the state's burden to put the defendant in substantially the same position as if he had claimed his privilege in the absence of a state grant of immunity, if he were in the same position, the police wouldn't be there. If he were in the same position, there would be no opportunity for Mirandizing. So how do you meet that test of Castigar?
Well, because it says substantially and not exactly, and we believe that substantially is fulfilled because his statement to the parole agent itself will not be used against him in court. He's got direct use
right.
immunity. And as to a second statement to the police, that won't happen unless he allows it to. So he can invoke his right and say, no, not only do I not want to make a statement to you under Miranda, but in effect he's saying, no, I'm also going to prevent you from obtaining a statement from me as derivative evidence.
So your voluntariness analysis, to me, it covers both the usual voluntariness and attenuation, and it also answers the Castigar problem. Is that what I understand you to be arguing?
I think we're trying to draw it a little finer than that, but certainly the Miranda goes to both parts, the attenuation and the Castigar. We're saying we're just completely out of the Castigar type of situation because here we're giving him a protection that was not offered in Castigar and therefore was not rejected. And that protection that we're giving him is adequate to protect his Fifth Amendment rights. Secondly, in the attenuation argument, the Miranda also takes us a long way there, although in theory, you know, hypothetically, you could have a situation where the person was given their Miranda, but their waiver of Miranda was still under compulsion of the first statement. And in that case, for that second reason, we might not be able to get it in. So they're very linked, but it is still two separate arguments. That Castigar and Evans and Murphy don't prevent this because they didn't say we couldn't do this. No one had, it wasn't offered there. And on the separate argument that, well, he's still under the compulsion of the first, we believe all the attenuation factors show that that is not, including the Miranda rights, but not exclusively that.
Ms. Wellman, can you explain to me, perhaps more clearly than I understand it at this point, the policy argument that the state is making, too? And by that, I'm referring to the reference to the administrative code section in regard to probation and parole agents and their obligations. How does that enter into all of this?
Well, I think certainly, obviously, if the Fifth Amendment prohibits what we've done here, then no policy argument, no matter how compelling, is going to carry the day, nor should it. I think what our policy arguments show is that this interpretation that the Fifth Amendment doesn't prohibit it because we're giving the defendant as much protection as the Fifth Amendment requires, we're protecting him from the dangers of incrimination by telling him he doesn't have to talk to the police and giving him that choice, that that's consistent with all of the policies behind parole and probation, which is that we allow people to be on release. Sometimes we have to allow them to be on release when they reach a certain date or time. And we need, for their rehabilitation and for the protection of the public, we need to be able to supervise them. And in order to do that effectively, we need to be able to tell them, you have to be truthful with your agent, and we need the agent to be able to cooperate with police for the safety of themselves as well as the rehabilitation of the defendant. Although short-term, of course, most defendants would like it if they can commit a crime while on parole and not be punished by being convicted of that new crime. That's not consistent with rehabilitation in the long run, and it's not consistent with protecting either the children in this case or in another potential case, or the agent herself or himself. There are situations where the agent needs to go into the home or maybe confronting the defendant one-on-one and needs to communicate with the police, and we shouldn't, you know, put in artificial barriers to that. I mean,
that may be true, but that doesn't involve compulsory incrimination. They can go into the home. That doesn't violate the Fifth.
Well, it could if, for example, an agent is going to search the home as she's allowed to do under his probation rules and has reason to believe that she will find guns there and she wants the police there to protect her. I think that...
That's all acceptable. It's when she asks the direct question to the defendant, to the parolee. That's when you get into trouble.
Well, but suppose she does and he's the one who says, yes, I have lots of machine guns and I have the makings of a bomb and I put it all together before I left and I don't know exactly what time it's going to go off. You know, she should be able to tell the police that to protect herself and others. And if it turns out that he does have those things, the police shouldn't be prevented from them talking to him about it. And if he also confesses to them after waiving his Miranda rights, that's fine. Now, it's all well and good to say, well, the court could just overrule Evans.
Is that what you want us to do?
No, no. We don't think you need to overrule Evans.
Why
Evans
not?
Is fine when you don't have this extra thing that happened in this case, which is that a crime came to light that the police were unaware of. The agent told the police of the possible crime. They then asked the defendant, in essence, will you talk to us about this? Gave him his Miranda rights. He waived them. By doing that, he not only waived his Miranda rights the same way he would if he weren't a probationer at all, but he also waived, another way to look at it is he waived any derivative use immunity that he might have as
so
to
counsel,
that statement.
Counsel, just so I understand the state's argument here, in regard to attenuation, the state is taking the position, as I hear it, that attenuation is a separate, parallel, alternate means to accomplish what Castigar said would be the goal under compelled, in the situation dealing with compelled statements, that it would be an alternative to the Castigar requirement of a wholly independent source.
When you have a Mirandized police statement, yes.
So you would start, the state's position would be that if not Castigar or Evans, wholly independent or derived from, then the analysis would run to attenuation if there was a Miranda following the compelled statement, but prior to, obviously, the initiation of the police interrogation.
Right. The only thing I would do a little different is I would flip it and I would put that you don't need the Castigar wholly independent in this situation because you have another protection that's constitutionally valid.
I think that kind of gets to sort of the underlying, one reads these cases and one sees the potential for tension. I believe Justice Bradley was asking questions of your opposing counsel that runs along the lines of the Castigar requirement for the wholly independent. And then is there some tension with that and your attenuation argument for the reasons that have been discussed by the other questions that but for the initial compelled statement, how do we even get to the attenuation analysis?
Right, and we're saying, one thing we're saying, even Castigar at its broadest didn't set forth a but-for test.
Counsel, it did, excuse me, are you finished? I don't want to interrupt.
I would just, Ms. Wellman, would you like to complete
and,
your sentence?
And two, I lost my train of thought for just a second. Oh, two, the Miranda, giving him the Miranda rights is what takes us out of the Castigar box.
I see.
You don't have to meet all the requirements of Castigar because we have this alternative that they didn't consider because it didn't happen there, it wasn't presented. And in addition to that, to make sure that we're properly separating the police statement, you can do that by requiring it to be attenuated.
If one looks at it, though, from the position of the maker of the statement, how would Mr. Spaeth have ever been aware? I mean, just from a very practical standpoint, from his perspective, he's given the statement to the probation officer. The probation officer has consequently and subsequently called the police. He's now being taken into police custody. It seems to me the state's argument is saying, well, the remedy is to re-Mirandize, plus the probation officer's statement here as he's, I think he was sitting in the squad car. You don't have to talk to them. That's true so far as it goes, but Spaeth would have no understanding. I mean, we don't know that he's a lawyer. In fact, the evidentiary record indicates that he's has some cognitive disability or borderline. So I don't know. I'm trying to see how the state's argument would actually effectuate the purposes of Castigar in protecting the compelled Fifth Amendment.
Well, we believe it effectuates because it simply doesn't address the situation because Castigar, everything comes at the back end. And we're saying, no, here's another way to protect, at least in this situation, and that's to give him his Miranda rights, which is giving him telling him you do have a right not to speak to the police. You have a Fifth Amendment privilege. You can exercise that. You can have a lawyer here. You don't have to say anything. And if you do say something, it can be used against you. That's enough to protect the Fifth Amendment right because it's giving him his Fifth Amendment right as to that statement. And the direct use immunity protects him as to his direct statement to the parole agent. No one's ever tried to get that in, nor would we.
Then would it come, according to the state's view, under the attenuation analysis to determine whether the time and location and the questioners have sufficiently been, there's sufficient distance between those two? That would all, according to the state's argument.
Right. We would build that all in both to show why it's adequate protection and for the separate argument the defense is making this. Even if Castigar had never been written, even if Castigar and Evans didn't exist, if you have a compelled statement, the second statement is compelled unless you can show that it's attenuated. Yes, I'm so sorry.
A few minutes ago, Justice Gableman was talking about the wholly independent test set forth in Castigar, and your response seems to be, well, the Mirandizing attenuates or brings it out of the, meets the test of wholly independent. But there's another test from Castigar that I don't know how you can meet, so tell me how you can meet it. And it's this, and I'm actually reading from one of our cases in Wisconsin, Tate versus Schwartz. I just happen to have that in front of me, that is quoting from Castigar. And it says this, immunity from use and derivative use prohibits the prosecutorial authorities, and this is quoting Castigar, from using the compelled testimony in any respect. And we see this. You've got, in Castigar, it has to be wholly independent, and you're prohibited from using the testimony in any respect. And it therefore ensures that testimony cannot lead to the infliction of criminal penalties on the witness. That's, after all, what the Fifth Amendment, right, the self against self-incrimination embodies. So how do you meet in any respect that it prohibits prosecutorial authorities from using the compelled testimony in any respect? It doesn't say, but if you Mirandize, then that's okay.
It doesn't, because it didn't, again, it didn't address that fact situation.
Any is a pretty big word, just like, well, they could have said independent, but it's wholly independent and prohibits use in any respect.
What we're saying is that's all well and good when all you know, all you have, is you have your compelled statement, then the police go and the investigators go off and they do whatever they do, and then they come back and they want to get in evidence. And then they have to show that they got that evidence, because the defendant, the witness, had no part in that, no control, no knowledge of that. Then the government has to show, okay, we got this by another wholly independent means. We didn't use your statement and then go ask Joe.
Yes.
But didn't Mr. Witness say blah, 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 blah?
That goes to wholly independent, but I'm talking about that they can't, they're prohibited from using that immunized statement in any respect. That's what I'm talking about now, that particular language from Castigar.
But they aren't using, I don't see it as violating that simply because it didn't say there is another whole way to protect. It's talking about a specific situation that you have where you have your compelled statement and then we're bringing in other evidence. Here, we cannot get that other evidence, that second statement, unless the defendant allows us to. And that's the difference. It would be the same way as if we went and said, okay, now we would like to look at your tax records because of things you said while you were giving your testimony. But we can't do that unless you let us, unless you give us permission. You don't have to give us permission. And that we're injecting, I mean, the thing that's, I think, takes it out of Castigar is that we're injecting something that simply was never contemplated there.
All right, let me see if I understand the state's argument. The state will not use the statements of a parolee probationer given that are incriminating, given in response to a direct compelling question, right?
Right.
Can't use it. You don't even try in this case.
Right.
Not gone. Forever. Ordinarily, these would be covered by Castigar. And the statements would, under Castigar, the response to the questions may not be used to incriminate in a subsequent proceeding, and they have use immunity. Mm-hmm. You accept that. Castigar is good law.
Yes, for use immunity.
For use immunity. But if, after the statements are made, the defendant is given a Miranda warning, not once, but twice, but once would probably do it, right?
Yes, once would do it.
Given a Miranda warning, you don't have to testify. You want a lawyer, you can have a lawyer. All the Miranda statements, and you say you don't have to tell us. And the defendant then incriminates himself. then we are outside of Castigar, and we are now in a straight Miranda case. And whatever the Miranda rules are as to voluntariness apply here, right? And it seems to me that once we're in Miranda, why do we have to go back to the first ones? So that's where your attenuation comes in.
Right.
Under straight Miranda. That's the state's position.
Yes.
What does that do to Castigar? Does it make a mockery out of Castigar, which Castigar says, never, never, never use, no use, no derivative use. The state has a big burden of proving independent. And so we're saying, what the state is saying, is that after Miranda, these statements become independent.
That would be another way to characterize it. I think it's a little less direct. I think what we're really saying is
that's what the actual reality is.
Yes. It's become independent.
It's become independent. So the even though they found out about the crime only through the defendant's own words, they were compelled. Nevertheless, this is independent. And it becomes independent by magic use of Miranda. Well, I added the words magic, not you.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah.
Okay.
Well, it becomes independent and it becomes permissible because it's consistent with the Fifth Amendment. I mean, we don't want to get so locked, and it's easy to do this sometimes, we get so locked into a particular case. What did the case say? Well, the case says that, but the case didn't have occasion to also say, but if we did this other thing that you didn't contemplate there because no one did it there,
you know,
would that be constitutional? And that's what you have to answer here.
I agree with that. And pulling language out of a case where the facts don't fit it, which counsel does and which the court does with some frequency, both of us do, because then we get bolster our conclusion, make it look more precedential. But I have a hard time when the holding of the United States Supreme Court is we hold that such immunity from use and derivative use is coextensive with the scope of the privilege against self-incrimination.
It doesn't say it's the only thing that is, though.
No, it's coextensive. And so if you're going to have after compelled testimony, I don't know how you ever get out from use and derivative use immunity.
If it's
coextensive with the Fifth Amendment, how do you ever waive the Fifth Amendment again unless you shout from the rooftops? And you can shout from the rooftops and you still won't. You already have the use derivative use immunity. You can shout until, like if you're acquitted for murder, you could shout, I did it, I did it, I did it, and you won't be tried again. Right?
Right.
For double jeopardy.
Right.
You could be Mirandized and you're not going to be tried again for double jeopardy.
But Miranda is giving you, telling you, you have this Fifth Amendment protection. You gave
before,
it up.
Before you talk. You've already talked, you're already immune.
You have use immunity, and now we're going to give you a better, another alternative, not necessarily better, but one that no one considered before because it didn't come up in those cases, which is, are we adequately protecting you from the dangers that the Fifth Amendment protects you from by telling you, you don't have to let us get this derivative evidence, this second statement. You can prevent that. Do you want to prevent it or not?
But did they say that in those many
words?
No, so he didn't tell them, you are protected, you won't be prosecuted, but if you talk now, you will be. He didn't say that.
Well, never said you won't be prosecuted because even Castigar doesn't go that broad. It's not transactional immunity.
No. But these words can't be used against you. He never said that. He didn't, the probation officer didn't say, you have confessed, but that can't be used against you.
Right, no.
But if you want to talk again, you don't have to talk again, but if you want to talk again, then they can be used against you.
She didn't tell him that last part, but the police did when they gave him the full Miranda warnings, okay. Yes.
Thank you.
May I?
Yes, Justice Prosser.
I asked your opposing counsel early on whether the statements to the parole agent were clearly compelled statements when they were after the polygraph examination. And she said, yeah, you cannot differentiate those things. Is that the state's position? Is everything in the interview with the agent compelled?
We certainly took the position that it was compelled. The facts don't precisely say exactly what the agent asked and exactly what she said, but certainly the agent's testimony shows that she believed the defendant understood that he had to answer her questions truthfully, even if that caused him to admit a rule violation or a crime, and that that wouldn't be used against him, that statement to her. There's no evidence in the record of exactly what, if anything, the polygraph examiner told him or what conversation they had separate from the agent. I do think if he were compelled to take the polygraph exam, which he was, I mean, he was required to as rules of his supervision, if instead of telling the agent, he had told the examiner, and we don't know if this happened here, but if the examiner had said, the test shows you're being deceptive, I think is the word they use, deceptive, and then he said, oh, you're right, I am being deceptive, I did do these things, and admitted it to him, we believe that would also be compelled, if that's your question. I'm not sure I'm answering your question.
It seems to me that would be clearly compelled.
Yes.
But here, after the polygraph examination, if he begins to volunteer information that not in response to a direct question, that's really the crux of this case for me is this. You seem to be asking the court to water down derivative use immunity as a lot of people have normally understood it. Okay, suppose we don't do that. The defense position almost seems to me that in a certain setting, in a context, the defendant can almost voluntarily blurt out stuff and thereby gain use immunity. I think that could be abused tremendously.
I suppose it could be. I guess on the record that we have here, I don't think I'm in a position to make an argument that what he said to the agent was wholly voluntary. He just volunteered it because she talked about after the exam and he had to test with the examiner. She wasn't in the room when that happens. Then the examiner comes and tells her sort of what the results of the test were. Then she goes in back in the room, and the examiner, Mr. Spaeth, and the agent are all in the room, and they talk about his conduct, and he made the admission. So from that, I couldn't say it. He just volunteered it. We don't know exactly what question she asked and what his direct answer to each question was.
My assumption is that the state is taking the position that it was compelled.
Yes.
Counselor,
both at the communication between the agent and Mr. Spaeth, and thereafter in the polygraph. If those are not the facts upon which the court is to decide this case, then we have a very different case.
We would have a different case. I think we'd have to have a new evidentiary hearing.
I was going to get to that.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Well, no, that's all right, because the court would be a straight Miranda attenuation case if it wasn't compelled.
Correct.
If it wasn't compelled, you wouldn't get to Castigar.
You wouldn't even need attenuation then.
That's right. He would be
a straight Miranda case.
It would volunteer in a straight attenuation Miranda case. I mean, could be many things, but it would not be Castigar versus a Miranda volunteer there kind of case.
Right.
And so we would not be in a position to decide that second kind of case because we wouldn't have a record.
Right. You don't have a record for that.
Justice Robitsek.
No, I don't have anything.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Veit.
Thank you, Chief Justice. Now, Justice Ziegler asked the state at one point to define the derivative use part of Castigar. And the state, more or less, as I heard it, was, well, that hasn't really been clearly defined. And I would submit it has absolutely been clearly defined. It was clearly defined in Castigar. And Castigar refers to, or at one point says, negation of the taint is
negation
not...
Negation of what?
Negation of the taint.
Negation of the taint,
yes. Of the taint is not enough. And what is an argument that Miranda is enough to get over the use and derivative use immunity standard in Castigar, what is that besides sort of a simple argument that there's a little negation to this taint? And Castigar specifically said you can't do that. And really, at this point, we're 40 years or so past, well, a little bit less than 40 years past Castigar. There have been many, many cases interpreting it. And none of those cases has suggested that Castigar is a sort of an alternative possible standard. It is the standard that applies when the government is, again, doing a judicially enforceable formal compulsion of information from the person. This is what the state has to do in return. It has to treat the person like they never made the statement.
Counselor, what you're essentially arguing is much like the Fourth Amendment doctrine, fruit of the poisonous tree, right? Is there a difference between the Fourth Amendment doctrine on derivative use under the fruit of the poisonous tree rationale from what you're arguing here in regard to Castigar? Or do you think they're same thing?
Oh, absolutely. They are not the same thing, Your Honor.
And how do they differ?
The fruit of the poisonous tree is about there's been an illegal action by a government agent. And you're trying to deter agents from doing that action. And so at some point, there's been enough attenuation from that that the deterrent effect has been accomplished by suppressing certain evidence. But maybe there's something that comes later on. There is no deterrent effect. Castigar is not about deterrence. Castigar, again, it's almost about judicial integrity. This is something where if he had refused to answer the question of his agent can go before a judge and have him imprisoned for refusing to answer. And so it's just a strict test. The government can't use that statement after he makes it. And that's not to say that there couldn't be an independent statement. Let's say rather than the police bringing him in and asking him about what the agent had just talked about, a week after making the statement to his agent, he just calls up the police and says, I have something to say. Well, the government's not using anything at that point. They may not even know about the immunized statement. You know, he can make that statement, but any time the government is using an immunized statement in their investigation, they're violating the rule of Castigar.
You know, I question the state, and I'm wondering if what I said was correct. If you're acquitted that and you confess again, you can't be tried. But if you take the Fifth, right, and then after taking the Fifth, you say something that does incriminate you and you're not compelled to do that, not compelled to say it, that statement can be used against it. You can't it.
Yes, potentially. I mean, again, you have the sort of the Bayer, the attenuation you're going to have to look
at. Yeah, but my point is what the state is saying, another way of saying what the state is saying is you, by being compelled to answer, you answered. And that's, you have now waived your, I don't know if you say waived, but your Fifth Amendment has been violated. But you get a second chance and you can claim your Fifth again, or you can waive the Fifth. And yet, when they give you the Miranda, this is an opportunity to again take the Fifth. And you don't take that opportunity. And so, and you speak. So that's okay. Why isn't that okay? Because we've both agreed that even after you take your Fifth, then you speak, you're not forever barred from incriminating yourself. So what's the matter with the state's position?
Immunity, excuse me, immunity is just a different bird. In immunity, again, it's a judicially enforceable formal compulsion. And it's a rule that applies to the government. You get to hear this information. You can do all sorts of things with this information. What you can't do is use it in a criminal prosecution, and what you can't do is use it to go investigating this person to find new information about them.
So it has
Miranda is not, like you said, it's not magic words. It's not all-powerful. And Miranda and Castigar are two completely different worlds. I mean, these come out of different Supreme Court cases.
So this is a matter of using his testimony or his statements against him by the government, and that's a violation of Castigar. Now, if 5 years elapsed, I want to keep it within the statute of limitations, but within 2 years elapsed, and then he goes around blabbing that he committed a sex offense against children, contrary to his probation, but what would you say? Can that be used, that new statement?
If 5 years elapse and the police say, oh, we think we can do it now, bring him in and ask about the statement.
I'm keeping the cops out of it. I'm saying he then volunteers this information.
I think that probably that would not fall within the grants of immunity because at that point he is making an independent decision. The government isn't using it against him. He's making an independent decision to talk to the police.
Well, counsel, do you think that the state's argument in regard to attenuation would be compatible with the requirements of Castigar if, in addition to the Miranda, prior to or concomitantly with, the state agent said something along the lines of what the Chief Justice had asked Ms. Wellman shortly before her time ended, which was, you know what you said to the probation officer cannot be used against you. Now we are going to ask you some questions, which you don't have to answer. Would that fit your understanding of the test?
I think if the police are questioning him about information they learned from the immunized statement, then that falls within Castigar. It falls within the grant of immunity. Again, even in this situation, if they had taken him into the jail but not questioned him, but he had independently gone to the police, you know, I don't want to concede exactly, but I think that would be a different question whether that would be independent. You know, he raises his hand in the jail and says, hey, I want to talk to a cop about something, and then, you know, volunteers a statement. But here we have police questioning on the basis of the immunized statement.
Okay.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you. You're out of time, Ms. Fite. I want to thank Ms. Wellman for stepping in. We appreciate that. Not the easiest case in which to step in. We haven't dealt with Castigar for a while, not since Evans, other than the Court of Appeals decision. And I want to thank you, Ms. Fite, both of you, for your excellent arguments on a very interesting decision relating to the relationship between Castigar and Miranda. That concludes the hearing in 09 AP 2907 CR, State versus Joseph J. Spaeth. And the court will meet in the conference room at 10 after 11 to discuss this case. And I will meet with the students right now. That ends the hearing.